Good evening and welcome to the living room of the city. It's lovely to see you. Looks like we'll be a small but very select number this evening. And now I'll just pass over to Barry, who is going to talk to us about an intriguing subject, one that I confess to not knowing much about, but I'm sure I'll know a lot more by the end of the evening. Thank you, Barry.
Thank you, Maria. Can you all hear me all right? So I'm lucky to be here myself. I was only at a hospital at 11 p.m. last night. So. Oh, that's when the shift finished. That's my dad joke. Don't do the dad joke. So this is the book that I wrote, the latest one, New Zealand Dress Regulations 1852 to 1909. So I'm a researcher studying New Zealand military history through the medium of uniforms and personal equipment. So that's anything they wore, anything they used, carried, quite a defined subject. I'm author of New Zealand Army Uniforms and Clothing, 1910 to 1945, with my brother, and New Zealand Army Personal Equipment, 1910 to 1945, also Matthew, and the OSPO book, whoever's interested in that series, New Zealand Expeditionary Force in World War II with Wayne Stepp. I've also written research articles on various topics, and if you want information on those, you can ask me. Yeah, I'm a collector of uniforms, clothing, equipment, badges, boots, anything really. I've got about 6,600 items in my collection so far. So why the need for a dress regulations book? The information was available and varied, but it was hard to resource and a load of folklore had crept into the subject. Official published material was referenced when I did write the book, as well as any other source that I could cross-reference. At the time, unit regulations are far too wide-ranging and mostly are undocumented. At the unit level, they would have had regulations, but they've been lost to time now. So doing dress regulations, it's a defined scope of dress regulations. It's not uniforms, it's not badges, it's dress regulations. And others have tried to do uniforms of the volunteer period, but as you might understand, uniforms of the volunteer period is an unending, quite a vast topic, and there's not much information about it. The book is not the last word on the subject, but the first. So don't sit there and think that I'm a know-it-all. Just use the information, develop it, take it to what you want to use it for, and grow it. The information should be shared and treated as organic, and allowed to grow and added to. That means no one knows everything. So share it. The book is designed to open up discussion, debate and research and to provide a common language and point of reference between interested parties. So that anyone who's got this book can say, turn to page such and such and they can discuss it. Museums can do that. So the book brings together all known dress regulations in one place, one font and in one format. So you can imagine that over the period of 1852 to 1909, how the dress regulations were promulgated and written up varied in script and style. So I've brought them all together into the same New Roman times 12, what I used, and it's all easy to read and understand. So the book is divided into two parts, which lists known specific regulations of the dress regulations. There might be more out there. Part two lists the imperial dress regulations, which are relative to New Zealand, and as well as reports, photographs of uniform features, quick reference guides, and 600 uniform colour guides for modelers and things. So who's actually read the book? Oh, you've read it. Good on you. So there's part three of photos of badges, uniforms, and accoutrements. I reckon it takes 2 weeks to read and 2 years to comprehend.
Good at night time,
though, Barry. Yeah, put this to sleep. Your wife might get sick of it. So I covered the militia, the volunteer, the constabulary, and the permanent forces. The militia, or the local militia, existed from 1840, and laws to govern the militias came in about 1845. volunteers from 1858 to 1909, when all volunteers transferred to the Territorial Force, and the constabulary locally from 1840. And the laws to govern the constabulary came about 1865 with the Armed Constabulary Force in 1867, and the permanent force in 1858. So far, to my knowledge, no one has tried to write about the uniforms of the Armed Constabulary, and what this book does is highlights that period as well. So I like papers past, and as you can see, there's a couple of newspaper clippings, but you've got to have a wee bit of you look at it carefully, because some newspaper clippings will say what they did, some will say what they're going to do, and you've got to ask yourself, did they go on and do that, carry on and do that? So the Naval Brigade received from Melbourne a sample suit of uniform, which they have adopted, so you can go on to say that, well, they have adopted it. But on the other side it says, the clothing factory are the makers, and if the fitting of the company is as good as that submitted, members should be satisfied with the results. So there's a wee bit of doubt whether they actually got them made or not, and they probably did get them made. Who uses papers past here? I like it. Yeah. So when I was studying the material for the book, I looked into early New Zealand and how it was established and how New Zealand functioned essentially, and it was divided up into small centres. It's not New Zealand as we know it today as one big country, it was small centres. There were very few roads outside the town centres, and the towns were still developing their commerce, and most travel was undertaken by ship. This was very early on. Sometimes it was easy to travel and trade with Melbourne, Sydney and Hobart. But when you think about it today, well, it's easier to travel to Auckland than it is to Sydney. So the language of the book, the dress regulations, were written in a grammar and comprehension style that is unusual to most of us today, especially the young people. The dress regulations were meant for the people of the time, so we have to sit down and think, what were they trying to say? How did they say it? And the dress regulations are not a date of introduction of an item, but a collection of the latest patterns and ideas from the previous period. So you'll get some people saying it's in the dress regulations and it's 1852. Well, it might have been introduced before that. It's just that they happened to print the regulations and it's mentioned there. So this is one of my corruption and grammar of meaning. In today's society, we do corrupt grammar quite easily, especially with texting. And the dress regulations have already been written, so there's no point rewriting them. If you know what the dress regulations say about a uniform, you don't need to call to write something else. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. The words and language has already been set, so there's no point redefining them. In today's society, words have crept in and corrupted the language of the dress regulation. This leads to confusion and misunderstanding, and by some, the glamorisation of an item. And the glamorisation is something that I'm quite hot on. So, commonly used words that have no place. Epaulette. We all call the items on our shoulders epaulettes, but they're not actually epaulettes, they're shoulder straps. And you won't find them mentioned in the dress regulations unless they're in relation to the naval regulations. Tunic and jacket always gets mixed up. Today most jackets are incorrectly referred to as tunics and vice versa. When you see on trade, you've got a tunic for sale, but it's got pockets all over it. It's not a tunic, it's a jacket. Pantaloons and jumpers. Only pantaloons are referred to in dress regulations, so there's no point calling them jumpers because they just weren't jumpers. And cartouche pouch, there was no official mention of this in the regulations, but if you go to, and a lot of people will call them a cartouche pouch, that's the shoulder pouch that sits on the back of the, so you have to be careful with that. So the pre-1909 period can be divided into three phases. Early period from 1845 to 1880, and that's when the units were getting organised and set up. The uniforms were cheaply made. The middle period of 1881 to 1894, that's when there were a lot of dress regulations were coming out, units were establishing. And the late period of 1895 to 1909, that is when we see a lot of uniforms from that period that have survived. They're the ones that are in our collections today and in museums. So any questions so far?
What's the difference between a tunic and a jacket?
I'm going to come to that.
And can you elaborate a bit more on that cartouche?
I will come to that. So do you know what a cartouche is when I mention it? Some units had shoulder belts with a wee pouch on the back that held ammunition, and people call them cartouche pouches, but they're not cartouche pouches, they're just pouches, but I will come to that. So 1881 I found was quite a pivotal year in the dress regulations, and a week after I printed the book, that came out with 24 regulations. Another regulation turned up, which was an armed constabulary regulation, which is Murphy's Law. So this 1881, the dress regulations of the Regiment of Artillery Volunteers was formed. And this is an important one because Artillery Volunteers was a huge organisation. And these regulations, there's 18 copies and one survives to Papua, I think it is, or the National Library. This held a lot of information, and it was the first really detailed description of how they wore and why they wore it and when they wore it, and that's included in the book as well. 1881, the officer's rank moved from the collar to the shoulder straps, so that we can see in photographs rank on the collar or the shoulder straps. And we can say that that will fit within a defined period because we know that that's when the changeover was. There's always going to be a little bit of slack either way. In 1881, there was a dispatch from the governor to the Secretary of State saying that New Zealand was not allowed to use the VR and cipher and the crown anymore. So we had to have our own buttons. But those VR buttons were still used well up until 1909, unofficially. And in the 1881 dress regulations for the armed constabulary, the mounted armed constabulary started wearing white helmets. So any photo of a mounted constabulary with a white helmet, you can say, is post-1881. So it's a great year, 1881, and it's a palindrome. So fashion had a big influence on uniforms. Smart uniforms were used as an incentive to recruiting. In European trends of the Garibaldi jackets, Zouave trousers, Austrian knots, Russian braid, astrakhan, sabretache and Hessian boots all crept into the official language of the dress regulations. So we get all this European fashion and trend coming to New Zealand. And does anyone know how astrakhan is made?
Sheepskin.
If you're an animal lover, you might want to block your ears. Astrakhan is the tightly woven fleece of an unborn lamb. So how do they get the unborn lamb? They obviously have to kill and eat the mother and get the lamb. It's quite freaky, really.
Well, they still have astrakhan hats.
Yeah, they're probably
it's
not made
Malaysia, of it. Created in
sort of
fashion.
Nepalese and things.
Yeah, or even in Uzbekistan.
Yeah.
And around that area, they're still producing.
It's most likely a really old type of fabric. Any question on fabrics? Or Hessian boots have a wee V at the top, and they were from European armies. The British conquered them and took that style of boot, and we copied the British. So each corps corps had their own patterns of full dress and undress uniforms, and if you know these patterns, you can narrow down the most likely pattern that it is, or unit it is. And each unit used similar styles to the uniform of the British Army to which they were aligned. Infantry of the Line Guards Regiment and Scottish Corps. So the units in New Zealand aligned themselves with units in Britain and borrowed their patterns. So you can see that if a uniform was this pattern, it matches the one in England, there's a progression of a lineage of design that goes through that.
Barry, the point there, though, is that many of the individuals who came out to New Zealand during the land wars actually demobilised in New Zealand and stayed here and didn't go back to England. So they retained the uniforms that they came out with.
Yeah.
And a lot of the militia and volunteers that grew from the 1860s, you know, right up until the early 1900s, actually utilised that uniform.
Definitely, and then the patterns of those uniforms began to evolve into New Zealand uniforms. And maybe what I should have said is what I didn't include in the book, and I didn't include Boer War uniforms, I didn't include New Zealand wars, or the New Zealand or the English regiments in New Zealand. Because if you were commissioned in an English unit and came out here, you were still allowed to wear the uniform of your English unit.
Oh, one question. Would it be all year round weather? I mean, wear clothing?
Yes.
So they didn't have summer and winter?
Yes, essentially.
Being war workers.
Yeah. And you've also got to look at the volunteer units and their... New Zealand was a rural economy and a rural country, so their... the units had to work, and the annual camps and exercises had to work around the harvest. So they didn't plan exercises during harvest time because everyone was away working on harvest. The towns were small, and so a lot of the rural units were mounted because you had to have a horse and you had to have a saddle and you had to have a feeder horse. And early units were established by wealthy landowners and merchants, and those units bear their names, like the Stubborn Mounted Rifles and things like that. Any questions? So we find a full dress and an undress. Undress is usually in the form of a patrol jacket, and I'll get to those later. And the patrol jacket's a dark blue, worn on the field, and was plainer in distinctions in colour. Undress uniform was supplied by the government and as such had to be returned once a unit was disbanded. And that's why we don't find a lot of undress uniforms around. Does the museum at Lyndon have many undress uniforms, but plainer?
No,
they have a lot of full dress.
Yeah, we've got photos of undress.
Yeah. And the patrol jacket morphed into the service dress of today. Well, it morphed into a service dress, which morphed into camouflage clothing, I would imagine. Full dress was colourful and worn on parade and for ceremonies. Full dress was owned by the unit and were purchased through fundraising donations, as well as being funded through the yearly government capitation grant, or part thereof. Because full dress uniforms were owned by the unit, they were not required to be given to the government on disbandment, and as such, they are the most common type of garment found in public and private collections. So in Nana's closet there might be a uniform, you'll probably find it's a full dress uniform because it belonged to the unit, and when it disbanded they took it home. You won't find the undress uniforms as much. So the red one is full dress and the blue patrol jacket. Undress patrol jacket. So the red jacket is from the 3rd Battalion Otago Rifle Volunteers, about 1872. No, that's later. And the other one, That is a patrol jacket, cavalry and mounted infantry officers as described in the New Zealand regulations of 1889 para 27. So it has a scarlet collar.
You
said
the red one's a jacket.
Oh, sorry, tunic. Yeah. Even I get it wrong.
Tunic without pockets and a jacket with pockets.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes, that's right. Does that one on the right have toggles to do it up?
Yeah, that's what I was
wondering. It's got flips on.
It has got the oilets, O-I-V-O-L-I-V-E-T, the net cloth netting covered olives, essentially. And
metal.
They're just decoration.
Oh, they've got metal, have they?
Yeah, the jacket itself is closed by a series of hook and eyes down the front.
Yes.
And there's decoration loops, mohair loops, and ovelets on each side. Some are missing on that garment.
Pretty flash, aren't they?
Yeah.
If you saw the uniform that Prince Harry wore at his wedding, that's as close to that from the Guards Regiment.
Yeah. So,
carries on from the origin of the Guards Regiment.
The Guards Regiment have a different cuff, and I think we're getting to that. So the red tunic is an infantry of the line tunic.
Second lieutenant, by the look of it.
Yeah, one pip is missing on that.
Those villains on the right one, are they Sook or...?
The which ones?
The right, the field ones.
Yeah.
Are they Sook or...?
What's it called? It's a blue, woolen, a really dark blue woolen fabric.
Take the toggle bits.
Well, they are mohair.
Oh,
mohair braid.
What is that? I'm just trying to think what the military stuff is. They have a name. Twill.
Twill?
No,
that's the
trick.
And the trout. Hard wearing when you're on a horse.
Yeah, but that's not it.
So from 1881, the rank of officers was moved from the ends of the collar here to the shoulder straps. The use of stars and crowns was commonly used to tell rank, but the combination changed over time. So at the back of the book, there's a list of stars and rank combinations. And the stars and crowns were used with... used with lace as well on the collar and cuffs. And until 1902 in the British Army, captains had two stars, but this didn't change until in New Zealand until the 1912 dress regulations. So there's a lot of misinterpretation of volunteer uniforms with two pips that they think is a lieutenant when it's actually a captain. And the same with photographs. So NCO rank remained relatively as standard during the period. So some of the photos we see are of men with large beards, facial beards. So you can imagine that if they've got their rank on their collar, on each end of the collar, you're not going to be able to see the rank, and it makes interpreting the photo quite hard. Pardon?
Lieutenant Colonel.
Yeah, I don't think it's that though. Possibly. That's Southland Mounted Rifles.
Yeah, crown of a book on either side.
So the photo of the collar, that's actually of a tunic belonging to Captain James Gardner of the Southland Hussars. So that's where we have to be a bit more.
Yeah, but that was after we were promoted, that looked like.
No, that rank is for captain.
For the crown and a pip?
Yeah. You haven't read the book, have you?
I have. I should have written to you. See, that's an error.
Wow.
Yeah.
These garments
machine stitched,
are they?
Yeah, I was
going to
ask that too.
The
machine stitched.
At that time, they'll all be hand embroidered, I would imagine. Hand embroidered.
Yeah, but I mean, it's a garment stitched by machine because they did have machines.
The
quite
fabric
early.
Will be woven.
Yeah, but I mean, the whole garment's put together.
Probably
if I was a seamstress and making one, would I be doing it by hand? Would
some
I
of
be
it would be by hand, some of it would be on machine,
yeah.
I would imagine.
I was thinking
sewing
machines would
be. They were finished by hand for sure.
Certainly in more recent times, they were still finished by
hand.
Oh, yes.
What are you seeing?
No, I won't see
you. So, this one that you've got down the front, what year is this one from?
That's very late volunteer period. So that's that was worn between about 1900 and 1909. And that's from the Canterbury Infantry Battalion.
Because that looks like it would be machined.
We'll have a look and find out easily enough.
Yeah, that will be machine stitched and then finished and hand sized in hand.
The linings would be sort of cotton sheen or something like that. Nowadays they're with polyester.
It could be a linen.
Linen.
We can look at it later if you like.
Okay. They used to sew a lot.
So the rank, there was a question about the rank. So in 1874, captains wear a crown and star, and that's the dress regulations for officers of the army, 1st of November 1874. And that's English regiment, it's English hussars. And because that tunic, full dress tunic, is New Southland hussars, do you know that tunic, Aaron? They continued on with the rank. So this, there is a section in the book for officers' badges of rank. So they had brevet majors and things like that. They only had a star. So it is really quite technical.
Confused.
Yeah, definitely. And you find the amount of braid and the width of the braid and the eyes all indicate the rank as well.
That one's got
toggles. Ovelets. I don't know how to pronounce it. Ovelets.
I was wondering what is inside the piece to make it as stiff as it is, so that, you know, it's going to be constantly opened.
And that piece there?
Yeah.
And that piece there is a wooden, like a duffel coat button.
Okay. Yeah.
Toggle.
Yeah, toggle.
Yeah.
And that would go through that loop.
Yeah, and most of those loops are. Most of the loops and the toggle there are fashion, and there'll be hooks and eyes for security to secure the main garment.
It looks like it's kind of got other colouring through it. Is that just kind of a brocade, is it?
This one, these here?
No, on the garment itself I'm talking about.
Oh, here?
Yeah.
Oh, that'll be dust and dirt.
Oh. Sure. It's too regular for that.
The more you brush it, the more it attracts.
Yeah.
So we'll go back to
it.
So if you want to identify a uniform, you can break it down into its smallest parts, and each part will tell a story, and when you put the parts together, it is likely to, or most likely to, present you with more information that you can then go ahead and interpret that. So this round twisted shoulder cord of a universal pattern, the one on the red, as we see a lot of that. A plaited wire shoulder cord, there's one on the other side. And in the centre is an engineer's shoulder cord, treble twisted shoulder cord, an engineer's pattern for you.
Yeah.
Especially for
a captain. Yeah.
For a captain,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Any questions on those?
It's quite hierarchical, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a lot of peacocking.
Yeah.
Yeah, my tail feathers are bigger than yours.
Yeah.
Cuffs tell their own story, and in the book there's a section on cuffs and how to identify them. So the one with two chevrons is a cuff of officers of field officers' rank, and Trev, that's the same colour and tunic we saw today at the museum. And this one has got a row of, as worn by infantry officers of the line, described in the 1883 dress regulations, two rows of lace along the top of the cuff with braided eyes above and below the lace for colonels and lieutenant colonels, and only above the lace for majors. So this is where it starts getting really, really technical. All I can see is lace. But there is above and below the chevrons, and the collar, or the cuff, is this part here. So then you've got your chevrons, and then you've got your two rows of lace above and below.
Those cuffs look like they're velvet.
It could be.
Yeah. I mean, soft, aren't they?
Yeah. The lace is to extend 8 inches and the Austrian knot to 10 inches from the bottom of the cuff, making the cuff pointed. Between the rows is a gap showing regimental colour facings. Below the chevrons on the cuff is an extra detail of figuring. Similar pointed cuffs were worn by medical officer, medical ordnance, veterinarian departments and things like that. So when you get to lower ranks, they started reducing the amount of eyes to the top and the bottom, and then they started reducing the number of chevrons. So on the other side, it's called an Austrian knot, and it's square worsted cord with worsted figuring below. That's a nice velvet cuff. And I think that one's on a other ranks jacket.
Excuse me, Barry.
Yeah?
With the World War I, World War II officers' uniforms, you got that, you pointed out last week, that V that comes up their sleeve,
yeah.
And you know it's an army. Does that come from that type of thing?
Yeah, yeah.
So that's sort of left over from this?
Yeah, you can see those features that travel through.
Yeah, right, okay, cool.
So lace was worn on the cuff. It showed the rank, the amount of lace, the amount worn differed between officer ranks. Figuring was used above and below the lace, and the height is different as well. So it's silver versus gold lace and braid. There's been a lot of misinformation about the use of gold braid in New Zealand by volunteers, and some people say that the volunteers didn't use gold braid, but they did. In this photo we see rank of captain on the shoulder, which is 2 stars, which is not the captain that we know today, which has 3 stars. On the cuff we have the rank of and braid of a lieutenant with 1 chevron. So why? Any questions? Any?
Yeah, they always wear gloves, don't
they? In that state of, he's got 1 glove on and 1 glove in his hand.
Yes.
And in that state of dress they would have worn gloves.
Mm.
Yes. So this is where we can use the uniform regulations to start digging down deep into what a photograph is and what it's trying to tell us.
So if someone's promoted, do they change the cuffs or do they give them a totally new uniform?
I think, in my interpretation of this photo, is that he's been promoted to captain, but he's still wearing his old lieutenant's uniform.
Mm-hmm. Except remembering the number of chevrons and the number of lace were determined by whether they were below field rank or field rank and above. And
yep.
That was the determinant on the sleeve as opposed to the badges of rank on the shoulder.
It should all match.
Yeah.
And this one doesn't match.
No, I realise that.
So this is why I think that he's been promoted.
Yeah.
And as so far he hasn't got his new tunic.
That'll bring me wrong.
Yeah. This is infantry of the line full dress. This is for an NCO, identified by coloured facings and pointed cuffs. That's from F Company, 1st North Canterbury Infantry Regiment or Battalion.
Did they have pockets in their trousers?
They had a ticket pocket, but you weren't meant to put your hands in your pockets.
Oh.
So you don't find pockets in trousers until about 1920, I think, especially for other ranks. Although the British did have World War I, they did have.
Would they call them trousers if there were no pockets?
The star is an efficiency star for rifle shooting.
Yeah, it's a marksman.
So you see this one, the jacket on the tunic on the screen is a Canterbury regiment, Canterbury tunic. And this one down here is a Canterbury as well. But that one's 2nd Battalion, and this one's 2nd. This one's 1st Battalion, and that one's 2nd Battalion. And you can tell by the different coloured cuffs.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking regarding the pockets, like men's suits, they have pockets.
On the inside.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a different thing.
But they discourage those too, because otherwise if you stuffed everything on the inside, you look as though you were wearing a bra or something. You wouldn't be uniform when you were healthy weight.
Okay.
There's probably not much that you would have wanted to carry back then.
No.
You wouldn't need a cell phone.
Or a pen or a handkerchief or something like that.
You'd need semaphore flags, wouldn't you?
That's true.
So this is a Guards Regiment full dress, and this is from the Invercargill City Guards, and it has straight cuffs, the one for it had pointed cuffs, and it's got the 3-point flaps, and each of those four white cloth areas around a button are called loops. So essentially it was one piece of fabric sewn together and then sort of squashed in to make a loop.
Ruched might be the
expression. Ruched?
Ruched. Bunch something up and sew a seam.
And officers' jackets of the guards pattern had the silver or gold braid around the button.
Looks like he lost the bottom button and put on a little one.
Why is that? Good point. Why is that?
The belt.
You didn't need one because your belt was covering it. And if you did have one, your belt would rub it and would stand out and would stand flash. So that's nothing wrong with that whatsoever.
Oh, so that was meant to be.
Yeah. A Company, Invercargill City Guards. That's an Oamaru museum. Badges. And we have Nicky Robert from Roberts and Robert Embroidery, what do we call it? I call it Roberts because I'm a Kiwi. I'm a Kuth Kiwi. I'm really happy to have you here because Robert and badges are synonymous with the New Zealand military as well as secular, or not as well as monastic and churches and lodges and stuff like that. They used to make heaps of badges, and a lot of badges have the Robert label on the back. Unit badges on the collar came about from about 1881, so we see a big proliferation of collar badges that everyone likes to collect. So if you've got a jacket, a tunic with collar badges on, you can guarantee that it's most likely post-1881. And they were used to show their individual unit design. So by this time, units were starting to be identified, had design buttons, and rich units could afford a better design and actually have buttons and badges made. Metal shoulder titles were first mentioned in 1895 in the dress regulations, and the one on the screen is New Zealand Artillery Volunteers.
The badges artillery as well, second place.
Wow. Metal badges have been well researched, but there are always new designs being rediscovered. And in the dress regulations book, there's three or four or five badges that have never been reproduced in books before. That badge there was a mystery to collectors for a number of years, and it would have been made by Robert's at Palmerston North. And it's for, does anyone know what it's for? That's for the garrison artillery.
Garrison, yeah. Because they've only got 7 flames. Which is quite distinctive.
Yeah.
And where did you say they wore that? Was it here?
This will be on the cuff.
Oh, right.
On the lower sleeve. Mm. So if you've got any badges with the Robert name on it, I think you're collecting them, aren't you?
I am.
You've become a collector.
Yes, I'm trying to get some of them back.
Yeah, and luckily the company is researching and restoring and cataloguing it all, which is good. Buttons. Buttons have confused a lot of people for a number of years. So in New Zealand, we used both locally, we used government-supplied buttons and privately purchased buttons. And the government-supplied buttons were quite limited in their design, and this includes the artillery buttons as well. most buttons were worn on the full dress, because as we saw on the undressed patrol jacket, it didn't need buttons. There's no evidence of metal button making in New Zealand, although some buttons had New Zealand retailers on the rear. And that's a controversial statement, but I'd like to be disproved. I'd like to find a New Zealand button industry that made all these buttons.
Did we make buttons?
Yeah, you did make buttons, but that wasn't until later.
Mm.
We get a lot of buttons, the volunteer period, that have Hallenstein Brothers on the back, but I don't think they didn't make them. So you can't say that button was made in New Zealand. It was just retailed by Hallensteins.
Was it engraved?
Embossed on the rear.
Oh.
And on the front was a unit design. So the first government-supplied buttons were the same as the British, and they had a crown over a VR. Plus there were other buttons of a horn button with a crown as well. But from 1881, in that year that I mentioned, the VR of the crown was not to be used anymore. So in the centre is what the New Zealand government came up with as an alternative to the VR, and that had the phrase around the garter on the outside with NZV in the centre, and this is mentioned in the memorandum to the Secretary of State in 1881. It's quite a hard button to get. And on the right is first detailed button mentioned in the 1895 dress regulations, but alluded to in the 1891 regulations. In 1891, that button was for the mounted units, but from 1895 it was for everybody.
And so it should carry on to the prison day.
Essentially it has, yeah, and they were still sewing them on their uniforms in the pre-World War I period, so they ran out of buttons. And yeah, it's the same, very similar design. Believe it or not, I believe they're commercially supplied buttons, and not government buttons. And the individual unit buttons are huge in number, and there's a number of them out there. So, commercial or government supplied, I'd like to be debated on that. The Garibaldi jacket. This is one of my favourite. Have you seen this one, Aaron? This is a distinctive design. And it looks like a battle dress blouse from World War II. So it's come full circle for 75 years.
Patrol blues.
Not really, because patrol blues have a skirt below the waistline.
Yeah.
That one's got a waist well. This has got the distinctive pastelon design of a crest around the front. And it was in use in New Zealand from about 1860 to 1870. And it was copied from Giuseppe Garibaldi, who was gallivanting around Europe. And that jacket is from the Westland Volunteer Rifles, and it's an officer's jacket, and I will tell you the rank shortly. Anyone want to guess the rank? Well, he's not a major, is he? Because we'd expect a major to wear a crown today.
Something next to it which I can't pick out.
A stain.
So would the clothing have been made in New Zealand at that time?
Some of it was made in Melbourne, some of it was made in other parts of Australia, some of it was made in England. And you've got to look at that time, in the early, really early period, New Zealand was establishing itself, so it didn't have a clothing industry or a badge industry, so that it was easy to get things from England or Australia, and that's where they got them from.
Okay.
As time went on into the 1870s, you do see New Zealand-made uniforms. So the second Westland Rifle Volunteers was accepted on the 26th of March 1868, disbanded on the 23rd of March 1870.
They didn't hang around for that.
So for 2 years, that's a really survival rate of is amazing.
Did they have shoulder pads?
Yeah, they are slightly padded. Yeah.
Layers of interfacing, that's other fabric
that
gives them the
garment
body.
Yeah, so at that unit, at that time, that rank was a lieutenant.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, there's four Garibaldis known in New Zealand, and I'd love to find more, and they're all down south. This one's in the Canterbury Regimental History Centre Museum. And there, until the book was produced, no one had really documented the Garibaldi, but it's really relevant to New Zealand, to early New Zealand. And this is the only officer's version that I know of. It's got silver cord loops with crow's feet at the end. This particular one's quite light. So this is a Norfolk jacket. It's a style that was introduced in the first dress regulations about 1895, and it is quite distinct. But by 1897, 2 years later, there were orders issued to state that the pleats had to be sewn up. So these sewn-up pleats can be found on jackets, on later jackets, just as sewn seams. So the tradition carried of these seams down the front, down the east side of the front opening. So that's the only Norfolk jacket that I could find in New Zealand, but they are quite relevant. They've got an integral waist belt as well. And they've got a box pleat at the rear. Patrol jackets, these are a nightmare. So they all look blue and they've all got black braid all over them. But if you count up the number of loops, a loop is something that goes across because the fabric loops over itself. Count up the number of ovelets down the front and how many rows of ovelets, it will tell you what unit it is. The one on the left is an engineer's pattern. Have you got one in this history centre? So this has got 5 rows of loops and 1, 2, 3 columns of ovelets. And it's got a red collar underneath as in the engineer's pattern. On the right is New Zealand Artillery Volunteers with a false collar, and that false collar has got grenades on each end, and this false collar was used to simulate the wearing of a waistcoat underneath. And the number of, And in the book, there's an appendix that lists out all these patrol jackets and the number of loops and the number of ovelets and the width of the braid and all that, so that you can identify those. And there's two more, and they all look the same, don't they? So these are undressed patrol jackets. On the left is New Zealand Militia, 5 rows of plaited loops, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And on the right is a volunteer's patrol jacket of 4 rows of plaited loops. If you see a photo, you can instantly tell.
And they've got pockets.
And they've got pockets, yeah, patrol jacket. One's got internal pockets and the other one's got pockets with flaps. So anyone know what that one is? It's what?
It's
Chinese New Year.
Chinese.
I think it's
about
Quebec and
the Canterbury
region.
Yep, good on you. Yep.
The band, the colour sergeant.
It's got the same coloured cuffs as that one down there, so it's the same unit. It's the tunic of a drum major with crown and inch lace. And this example is to the 2nd North Canterbury Battalion, and it's the same unit as that. So they probably knew each other. And the 1st Battalion had black facings, is what we saw in the other slide.
Would they be put epaulettes sticking out from the shoulder straps?
Their bird's nests, I think they're called. They're colloquially called. Yeah. And you get different combinations of this crown and inch lace, so they could stand out. Because in the olden days, the drummer gave the commands in the field, and they had to know where the headquarters was. So he stood out like dogs, you know what. Hats and caps, what's the difference? Anyone hazard a guess? A hat has a brim that goes all the way around, and a cap just has a peak or no peak. So once again, we get this corruption of people calling a hat a cap and a cap a hat. So it's already been invented, why reinvent it? And in the dress regulations you'll find that this is a cap with French peak, and that's exactly what it is. This is from the Western Rifle Volunteer number 2. I don't know if it was made by Rebears, it's probably quite too early for them. Yeah, this is a pre-1870, possibly made in Melbourne, I would imagine. And the French peak is identified by the angular nature of the peak in the front, and on the front edge is a row of braid. And all this is mentioned in the dress regulation, so once you break it down, you can start, the picture starts to form. Right, not a pillbox cap. Never again call it a pillbox cap. It's a forage cap, not a pillbox cap. So the colour and design of the braid is... fashion of the 50s maybe. I don't know where it came from, pillbox. Maybe the pillbox is from, round pillboxes from World War I or the Boer War, I don't know.
Relating to tools that is medicine.
Oh, medicine.
Yeah.
And collar boxes.
Yeah.
That type of thing. So the colour and type of braid will indicate whether it's in other ranks or in officers, and how high the braid is, what rank you are. The design on the top of 8 loops around a central button is not found in British units, but can be found being worn in Canada, Australia and New Zealand, indicating that it's a colonial pattern. Forage cap figuring. So all this fancy stuff on and uniforms that we see made out of Russia braid is called figuring. And on the left is the Royal Artillery pattern, and we use those here. It's described as 4 rings of Russia braid with the outside ring forming 8 loops and an eye between each loop. And if you look at it closely, you can see that that's what it is. That's what they're talking about. And also the artillery forage cap has a red rim around it as well. And on the right, the other cap is one of the many hussars patterns, and they had a couple of dozen different patterns of hussars.
I think that's from the basket,
wouldn't
it,
isn't
it?
Yeah, that'll be a basket where you covered the button. Yeah. Riversdale Rifle Volunteers. These are forage cap with drooping peak. And that is how they are described in the dress regulation. So that is how we should describe them. That's got a lovely badge. It was probably made by Robiers, Palmerston North. So these were first mentioned in the dress regulations in 1886 in relation to officers of the militia. On the left is the Riversdale Rifle Volunteers, who served from 1886 to September 1889. And on the right is a... engineers. Yeah. Helmets. The white helmet was introduced in Britain in 1877 and first mentioned in the New Zealand dress regulations in 1881, although it is highly likely that units got it before that time. The blue helmet was introduced in Britain in May 1878 and first mentioned in the New Zealand dress regulations in 1886, and once again, most likely used well before that. Officers' helmets were more ornate, with pointed peaks and square rear peaks. So they're both First Canterbury Battalion. The cap on the left is an officer's, the helmet on the left is an officer's version with a metal rim that runs around the front peak. And you can see how the other rank's version, the badge is different. It's not as ornate, and it's just got a leather rim around the whole helmet. And the court, the artillery, the medical, engineers, they all had a ball on their helmet. So anyone know why we used a ball, and why they used a ball instead of a spike?
A lot less painful
to sit on. A lot less painful, yeah, a lot less painful for the horse. Because you can imagine the fact then, the corps used the horses for transport, and they had to saddle up a horse, and bending down and doing things with a horse with a spike on their helmet was quite unfortunate for the horse. So they use a ball. And this is a field service cap, originally known as an Austrian pattern field service cap. So once again, it's not one of those colourful terms that we like to call it, a folding cap or a wedge cap or anything like that. It's a field service cap. And the centre of the cap can display the colours of the unit colours. This one's from the Geraldine Rifles.
Could you fold that one?
Yes, you can fold it flat.
Yeah, and put it up in.
Under your shoulder strap?
Yeah.
Or in your pocket, if you had pockets. So this is a forage cap naval pattern. So you can see the forage cap has changed from round, it's added a drooping peak, and now we're coming to a more of a traditional cap that we know today, but they're actually based on the naval uniform. And the cap is the forage cap came with a peak and a flat crown. So this one belongs to, anyone want to guess who this belonged to? What unit? Badge is probably made by Robiers of Palmerston North. He was a chaplain.
So
a volunteer chaplain. The pouch belts and sword belts. We see a lot of these in period photos. Shoulder straps, they're just, people call them all sorts of things, but they're just pouch belts, and later they got changed to a shoulder belt. Originally they were practical, but later they carried unit distinctions and badges. And these are what held a pouch or a telescope case or a medical instrument pouch. So some units had an undress pouch and shoulder belt, and some had a full dress and an undress. The top pouch is a late 1860s and came with the Western Volunteer Rifles uniform. It's plain brown leather and has a black pouch. Below is a full dress shoulder belt in the design of New Zealand Engineers. Yep, Engineers design. That is the top pouch. They're not cartouche pouches, they're pouches. Plain pouch. The top one is in a Japan finish with a horn badge, and that belonged to the Westland Volunteer Rifles. Below, an ornamental full dress pouch. So by the time we get into the later volunteer period, things were started to become purely ornamental. And the dress pouch, and this is for a
cell phone,
yeah, for the medical corps. This design is medical corps, so not engineers. But there is an engineers one in the book, I believe. Sword belts. Once again, you can get undressed sword belts that sat under a tunic, and you can get full dress sword belts that sat over a tunic and were a lot more elaborate. And the button, the waist plate, also carried the unit badge as well. And this is for number one New Zealand Engineers. Any questions? No? All right. So, that was my latest book 2 years ago. And this will wake you up. This one was at the printers this week. New Zealand Air Force uniforms, clothing, badges and personal equipment, 1923 to 1948. Once again, no one else had done it, so Muggins here did it. On the front is the same design as the other book. We've got a woman's hat, a warrant officer's air gunner's jacket, a gas mask and a pistol that was picked up in the Pacific, used in the Pacific by a New Zealander. And that's the contents. And we do have badges made by Robiers in there. I think.
How did you choose the date? They're very specific, like 1952 to 1909. So why those?
Because that's...
That was the period of the volunteers.
Yeah, 1852 is the earliest date I could find of a confirmed regulation, but there are mentions in the book going back to 1840, and 1909 is when we changed over to the territorial system, so the uniforms changed. And in December 1909, all the volunteers became territorials, and in 1912 they did the dress regulations. So they were still wearing volunteer uniforms right up to 1912 and probably even later.
1910, we had a visit from Kitchener, who came out to advise the New Zealand government on setting up a permanent force. So that 1910 was quite significant. He was out here for 2 or 3 months. It's quite a fair record of where he went throughout the country. And that was before they realised that World War I was on the way.
I don't study the people, the places, or the politics. I do what they were wearing and carrying when they were there, politicking themselves.
1923 is a significant date because that was the establishment of the Permanent Air Force in New Zealand.
So this is just a sample, couple of sample pages of what's in the book. Breaks it down into individual items and gives them a date range. And that's that. Thank you. Any questions? There's some flyers on the front table if you'd like to take one. It's got my email address, and if you've got any questions, you're more than welcome to email me.
How long did it take you to do
your
book review?
Well, this is actually my fourth book.
Yeah.
So about 2 years. The Air Force book was about 2 years as well.
No watching TV or anything like that.
No.
Ah, TV is
horror, isn't it? Two years is
yeah.
Not too bad. Right, something like that to deal with the research and everything.
Yeah. You know, you've got to sit down and you've got to look at the regulations and really figure out what they mean and why they mean. You've obviously seen the badges over there, and on the table is a Naval Artillery Volunteer's cap and the tunic as well. Feel free to have a look and ask questions.
Thank you.